Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 11th of January. We talk about the president's visit to the Middle East this first hour of today's program. In order for there to be lasting peace, President Abbas and Prime Minister Olmert have come together to make some tough choices, he said, and I am convinced they will. And I believe it's possible, not only possible, I believe it's going to happen, that there can be a signed peace treaty by the time I leave office. That's what I believe. We'll be talking about the president's first trip to this part of the world and whether or not there are hopeful signs that some kind of peace treaty could be reached and what the stumbling blocks are toward that treaty. Our guest is Professor Stephen Zunis. He is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, where he has taught since 1995. He is also the author of many articles on the Middle East, on politics, on U.S. foreign policy, international terrorism, social movements, and human rights. He's the principal editor of Nonviolent Social Movements and the author of Tinderbox, the U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. He has made frequent visits to the Middle East and other conflict regions where he has met with top government officials and academics, journalists, and opposition leaders. And in 2002, he won recognition from the Peace and Justice Studies Association as Peace Scholar of the Year. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We get many phone calls when we address this issue, so let me give you our numbers. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Our 800 number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Professor Stephen Zunis, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Why is it that the president has made this trip for the first time in his presidency?
Well, he's been under a lot of pressure to make this trip for many years now. And there is a growing awareness in Washington that Israeli military might alone is not enough to stabilize the situation, that some kind of a peace resolution would, even putting the moral and legal arguments aside, would be to the advantage of regional stability and U.S. national security interests. And so he is trying to make the case that the process should move forward. In addition, of course, he has an agenda in the Persian Gulf as well, including a number of issues unrelated to Israel and Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that he's kind of ignored this part of the world? Well, not the whole part of the world, but the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, he hasn't ignored it, but it certainly has not been as big a priority as the as previous administrations or as many people concerned about the area have indicated.
Mm-hmm. What about this general comment that he made yesterday that President Abbas and Prime Minister Olmert have to come together and make tough choices? He says he's convinced they will, and he also believes that there could be a signed peace treaty by the time he leaves office. Is that pie-in-the-sky thinking?
It is far more optimistic than most analysts would agree with. I mean, part of the dilemma during this whole process is that the United States has had this contradictory role of being both the chief mediator in the conflict and the chief supporter of one of the two parties. In fact, the more powerful of the two parties. And certainly both sides need to make compromises. I mean, there's a broad consensus that the Palestinians need to give up on this idea of the complete right of return of Palestinian refugees into what's now Israel. But most of the compromises that need to be made at this point are on the Israeli side, being the occupier, that is, on Greater East Jerusalem, on the settlements, on the extent of the withdrawal. But the United States has refused to push Israel on either of these issues. And when the more powerful of the two parties doesn't feel that push to compromise, it makes it difficult for a peace process to move forward.
Do you think that Israel is ready to move on that particular issue?
They have agreed to dismantle some of the more remote settlements and pull back in some areas. But by and large, they seem to be going ahead with this idea of colonizing these large swaths of territory in the West Bank and enclosing them in this separation barrier, which they're building in a serpentine manner deep into the occupied territories, which, for all intents and purposes, would divide the whatever Palestinian entity would remain or would emerge on the West Bank into a half dozen or more non-contiguous cantons, which, you know, most people would argue is not really a viable state.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me as though it would be extremely difficult, and I don't know who would do this and all that needs to be taken into consideration, but how you would redraw borders to establish a Palestinian state?
Well, I mean, generally, yeah, based on the UN Security Council resolutions 242 and 338, and the basic idea in the UN Charter that no country can expand its territory by force, one would go back to the borders pre-June 67. So there'd be a Palestinian state would be on the West Bank and Gaza, presumably connected by a 40-mile road with no exits, comparable to the highways that linked West Berlin with the rest of West Germany during the Cold War. And but the problem, of course, is that some Palestinians believe that 23% that would remain of historic Palestine is too little, and the U.S. and Israeli position is that 23% is too much, and the Israelis need to, and the Palestinians need to settle for more. The compromise that's been talked about, both in the Taba talks in early 2001, that came very close to a permanent peace agreement, as well as the Geneva Initiative in 2003 by a number of prominent non-governmental leaders in both countries, was that Israel would be able to annex certain settlement blocks right along the border and thicken certain areas that were they're kind of narrow, including some areas around East Jerusalem. But they would give an equivalent amount of land, but presumably south of the Gaza Strip in the Negev Desert area, to the new Palestinian state. So it would be more of a one-to-one transfer of land, and so that would make a Palestinian state therefore more viable than the current U.S.-Israeli plan.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about, because I don't fully understand this issue, the issue of compensating Palestinians for the homes that they left, how to compensate this huge number of people, it may be millions of people, where they are and whether or not this is a huge part of a peace treaty.
Well, Palestinians who were forced out of their homes as a result of the 1948 Israeli War of Independence have been living as refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, elsewhere, including the Gaza Strip and then West Bank, nearly 60 years. Many of them fled just to flee the fighting. There are some cases that are now uncovered in the Israeli archives of what we now call ethnic cleansing. And according to the International Covenant on Human Rights, refugees have a right to return to their country of origin. At the same time, that provision was written back when it was assumed it would be a matter of months or years,
right.
Not that of several generations.
It's a long time. Yeah.
And so the Israelis, of course, are concerned about the demographic implications, being that it would no longer be a Jewish majority state. And so the compromise people have been talking about is that these refugees would either get full citizenship in these Arab countries, which they've largely been denied, or resettled in the new Palestinian state. In fact, that's one thing they could do with these Israeli settlements that the Israelis would need to evacuate. These could be the new homes for the refugees.
Do you imagine there would be a great return of Palestinians?
I think a fair number, those who are actually in the some of these squalid camps. I think many, though, would choose to stay in the countries they've been living in. But there is there would be, I think, with adequate compensation, adequate international support, that hundreds of thousands could return to at least the part of Palestine that is the West Bank, and still be and could live fairly normal, productive lives there.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there have been so many attempts to broker a peace deal. Let's just talk about the players and whether or not I may be overstating the case to say that you need some strong players to negotiate some kind of a peace treaty. But you've got a president who's not very popular, who's on his way out. You've got Palestinian and Israeli leaders who some have said are not particularly strong. What do you need strong actors here? Are there strong actors to broker this kind of deal?
At the moment, it doesn't appear so. I mean, some people have risen to the occasion, and sometimes when the people demanded that leaders can rise to the occasion. Abbas is certainly not popular, but at least, thankfully, he's more popular than Hamas and their leadership is right now. Olmert is not very popular, but polls show that though he has critics on the far right, there are even more who are pushing him to compromise and head towards peace. In fact, it's interesting that public opinion polls after the Geneva Initiative in December 2003 indicated that a majority of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and a slightly smaller majority of Israelis, depending on how you word the question, were willing to support a peace agreement along the outline I described earlier, with a shared co-capital of East Jerusalem, Israel withdrawal from the settlements and occupied territories, except for the small and reciprocal border adjustments, and no right of return, but compensation for the and resettlement for the refugees. That a majority of people of both nations supported that. And so despite all the screwy things that the leaders have done and the lack of initiative by the United States, it still holds out, for me at least, some hope for peace.
Mm-hmm. What about, how much do you know about this Lieutenant General William Frazier, who the president has appointed to be a mediator here?
He doesn't have a lot of experience in this sort of thing. But I think one, there's been some concern that, having a military person, puts too narrow an emphasis on security issues. And while security issues, of course, are very, very important and very crucial, they really need to be taken in the context of larger concerns. For example, the level of Palestinian support for violence and terrorism has ebbed and flowed relative to the hopes for peace. When the peace process was moving forward, when there was real hope for a viable Palestinian state, the Palestinians were better able to control radical movements. There was less support for radical movements. But when the Israelis continue to expand these settlements, when there's ongoing political repression, when the roadblocks and checkpoints make normal commerce and transportation impossible, it leads the message by the extremists to have some resonance, namely that, see, compromise and negotiations don't do you any good. Things are just getting worse instead of better. Therefore, we have to take up arms and use terrorism to advance our cause.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, Professor Stephen Zunis, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. He also serves as an advisory committee member and Middle East editor for the Foreign Policy in Focus Project, and as an associate editor of Peace Review, he's written about this part of the world widely and has made frequent visits to the Middle East and other conflict regions. And we welcome your phone calls. What do you think about the president's visit? Is it too little too late? Do you admire him for trying to broker a peace deal during this last year of his administration? Do you think that it is possible? What do you see as the stumbling blocks? We'll also look at his comments about Iran and many other areas of discussion, of course. So join us, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with a political columnist for Pajamas Media. We'll start with Mayor Bloomberg. He's been carrying this story for so long. Is he going to launch an independent bid for the presidency, or is he not? We will be talking about that, and we'll also look at, the whole primary caucuses ahead, what happened in New Hampshire, and all of that. We'll talk politics again after 10 o'clock today. Professor Stephen Zunis with us now, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Art from Milwaukee. Hello, Art.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Fine show. I've got a little question here. There were probably as many Jewish refugees from Arab lands as there were refugees from the Palestine area in terms of the Muslims. Now, what about the compensation for those refugees? That's number one. And number two, what about all of the confiscated materiel of Jewish people in Muslim lands?
There were indeed a large number of refugees who fled to Israel and elsewhere as a result of persecution in Arab countries in the late 1940s into the 1950s. It's ironic because until fairly modern times, Jews had been far safer in the Arab and Islamic world than they had been in the Western Christian world. And waves of persecution in Europe, such as the Spanish Inquisition, it was the Arab and Islamic world that welcomed the Jewish refugees from the oppression there. And so this turn towards anti-Jewish oppression was a major tragedy. And a number of Arab countries have ranging from Morocco to Egypt and others, have recognized this and have offered some compensation and invited Jews to return. But, of course, by this time, most of the Jews from these North African and other countries have settled in Israel. But certainly there is degree, there is certainly responsibility, I believe, on both sides regarding the refugee situation.
Anything else, Art? All right, thanks very much for your call. Our lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. The president's trip to the Middle East, attempting to broke a peace treaty before he leaves office, so there's about a year to do that. What do you think of that? 800-486-8655. Let's put Iran in the equation. The president, before he left, again talked about Iran was a threat. Iran is a threat. Iran will continue to be a threat if they're allowed to learn how to enrich uranium. Also, Shimon Peres talking about Iran, saying that he wanted the president to stop the madness of Iran. And he talked about the Iranian threat, and it should not underestimate their resolve for self-defense.
Well, Iran, of course, is violating a UN Security Council resolution calling for it to end its enrichment program. Iran feels they're unfairly signaled out, since there are scores of other countries that have enrichment programs, but that given that they tried to hide their earlier nuclear weapons program from the International Atomic Energy Agency, this particular restriction that the international community believed was appropriate. The problem in terms of getting real leverage around it is that Israel has been violating a UN Security Council resolution 487, which has called on Israel to place its nuclear facilities under the trusteeship of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Israel's refused. Similarly, India and Pakistan have refused, abiding by Resolution 1172, which the Security Council called on them to eliminate their nuclear weapons program altogether. So with these other countries, allies of the United States, violating these UN Security Council resolutions without the apparent objections of the U.S., in fact, the U.S. signed this nuclear cooperation agreement with India and has been providing nuclear-capable jet fighters to all three countries, it's going to be hard, I think, to rally more support to put greater pressure on Iran, because the obvious question is why this double standard? Why Iran, which is years away from having a nuclear weapons and doesn't have a current nuclear weapons program, should be singled out when you have these countries that already have nuclear weapons and also violating UN Security Council resolutions get a free ride?
Mm-hmm. What do you make of this incident on January 6th, these Iranian speedboats, U.S. officials saying it was a very provocative act that came very close to resulting in an altercation between our forces and their forces? There's been a lot of confusion about what actually happened here. Do you have the truth?
I have no inside information on that. I mean, there. From the Iranian perspective, of course, you have this huge armada of ships in the world's most powerful navy, and a country that's been openly threatening to attack them right off their shores. And so they, and to their perspective, just sending out small craft to kind of check them out and see what's going on is not necessarily provocative. Indeed, the U.S. president, they would argue, is what's provocative. In this particular case, they may have gotten closer than usual. I doubt they were much of a threat, given that these are tiny speedboats and these were huge destroyers and the like. But there's it's a kind of cat and mouse game, or maybe chicken would be a better analogy, which is obviously dangerous. Some people, of course, have raised concerns that the U.S. is looking for a Gulf of Tonkin type incident to justify military action. Others speculate that there are hardline elements in the Iranian regime that would also like to provoke some kind of confrontation. But it's so on one hand, it doesn't seem to be that big a deal. But on the other hand, given what's at stake, it is certainly a matter for concern.
Right. You would hate to have seen an altercation here, and you wonder what the consequences of that may have been. It's a little
exactly.
bit frightening.
And, of course, you may recall that in the late 1980s when the U.S. sent in the Navy essentially to support Iraq's war effort against Iran, there were a whole series of confrontations between the U.S. Navy and Iranian craft such as these.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to be paying? The president is going to be their final stop in Egypt on January 16. What are you going to be paying special attention to as he travels to other countries in this region?
Well, he's been trying to get more support in terms of the of his hardline stand against Iran. And though, while certainly Arab countries, especially and Israel, have concerns about Iran's intentions, most of the Arab countries, at least, are very reticent about a policy that stresses confrontation and isolation. They do believe that they recognize, anyway, that Iran, for better or worse, is a major power in that region, as it has been for 2,500 years, and that they need to deal with it, and hopefully in a way that will not threaten their interests. So they certainly would like U.S. support in dealing with a number of the outstanding issues, but there is some concern about the U.S. going too far. Other issues, of course, are broader economic issues. President Bush and issues of oil, curbing Islamic militarism within these countries, and support for the Arab-Israeli process and peace process, and the fact that most Arab countries did show up in Annapolis, indicating their willingness to recognize Israel and live at peace with Israel in return for withdrawal from the occupied territories, is indicative that there should be some support. Support on that, not necessarily with Bush's particular tact, but at least with the concept, with the idea of a comprehensive peace settlement.
Yeah, I mean, it was rather encouraging, wasn't it, to see all of those nations? I was amazed all those countries showed up at that initial conference in Annapolis.
It was impressive. I mean, the Arab League has been on record since 2002 of supporting Land for Peace, of being willing to recognize Israel and have strict security guarantees in return for Israeli withdrawal. And it was reiterated in the most recent Arab League summit as well. And so this is the real existential threat to Israel's existence. You may recall in the early decades, they were surrounded by these hostile armies threatening to wipe them off the map. It's nice to know that those days are gone. The irony, however, is that back then it was the Arabs that refused to accept the Land for Peace formula when Israel seemed to be willing to accept it, and now the Arabs are willing to accept it, and Israel is refusing to go along.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome our phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. President Bush's visit to the Middle East and his attempts to broker a peace deal, saying that this, he believes, can be done during his remaining time in office. We go to Cecilia next. Hi, Cecilia.
Huh?
Hello?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Oh, but you're talking about Israel.
What? Yes, we are.
Well, what I wanted to tell you or ask you or suggest to you, they've made so much about Hillary Clinton missing up in the debate or when she was in New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
What I would like to say to you is, what is she going to do when she gets into a diplomatic situation, confrontation with Musharraf or Putin? Is she going to miss up? Do you think those men are going to feel sorry for her? Musharraf has already said that Bhutto should never have stuck her head out of that sunroof. She was asking for it, that she was to blame for her own demise.
All right, do you want to move American presidential race into the conversation?
Well, I could mention one thing, is that I don't think that Hillary Clinton being a female would be an obstacle for her diplomatic efforts or her being a commander in chief or leader of the United States in dealing with the challenging situations in the Middle East. I do personally, however, have some serious concerns about her policies. Particularly her seeming to align with the more right-wing elements in Israel versus the more liberal and moderate elements there, her support for the Iraq war and the way that she falsely claimed Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and were a threat, the way she falsely claimed that Iran still had a nuclear program when she didn't. I don't think the concern is that she's going to somehow be too soft. My concern is that she's going to, continue many of the same counterproductive, militaristic, and confrontational policies of the Bush administration that's gotten us in the mess we're in today.
It is interesting to me, after all these debates, how many debates have there been on both sides for months and months now, that this crucial part of the world has not been debated very fully yet. It's so important, isn't it? And maybe we just grow numb to, oh, yeah, talk about another peace deal. We've been doing this for years and years and years. We'll just toss it aside because it ain't going to happen.
Well, it has been a challenge. It has been frustrating. Part of it, in terms of Israel and Palestine, is that the Democrats tend to often be as hardline as the Republicans. I believe, outside Dennis Kucinich, I don't think any of the Democrats have aligned with the peace camp in Israel. Most of the major candidates certainly have tended to ally with the Olmert government and its policies. So it hasn't been as much of a debate as many people would like. In fact, the irony, of course, is that in Israeli politics and in the Israeli Knesset, there is more lively debate about Israeli policies and willingness to challenge some of those policies than you find in the U.S. Congress or in political debates in this country.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Mike from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. First of all, I am no fan of George Bush and his policy towards Iran, but I have to beg to differ with the guest on his appraisal of this Iranian incident in the Gulf or in the Strait of Hormuz. You got to remember, the U.S. Navy there, not that many years ago, less, I think it was about four or five now, suffered an attack in which a number of U.S. sailors died. A ship was nearly sunk by boats that were slower and substantially smaller than the ones that were within 200 yards of the U.S. Navy, and had radio traffic suggesting that there was going to be some kind of explosion.
You're talking about the incident in Aden Harbor when the coal was blown up?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah. That wasn't in the Persian Gulf, and that wasn't involving Iranians. But certainly small boats can do a lot of damage. Right? But the idea that the Iranians would, provoke an incident like that, that would, surely lead to war, seems kind of far-fetched. I mean, that is, of course, Al-Qaeda, that's very much their style of operation, these were,
the Navy.
Again, these are high-speed boats. They were not the kind of thing, they weren't laden with explosives and that sort of thing.
What is a Navy captain expected to do if he's got several boats, which are, these boats or that they're talking about are in the area of 40 foot long. Mm-hmm. That's half the length of a semi. And in a region of the world where suicide bombing is the norm.
From everything I know, I don't think I was objecting at all to what the officers did. It sounded quite reasonable to me. It told them you're too close. You better back off. And if we don't, we'll have to take action. I wasn't raising any objections to what the what the Navy officers chose to do. All I was doing was I didn't think that it was as serious an incident as some of the politicians are making it sound.
Thanks for the call. We need to move on to another line. Amy, is it from Madison? Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm not very hopeful that we'll see a peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians because, as I see it, the Israelis are always expanding the settlements that are on Palestinian territory, and as I understand it, they were even continuing to expand Jewish settlements during or right after the Annapolis conference. It's as if they just feel that they can do anything they want but say the right thing at these conferences. I think their actions are very provocative, and Bush gives them credit for saying that they will dismantle what are called illegal outposts. Those are just trailers that someone has put up with an Israeli flag. He gives them credit for saying they're going to dismantle them. I think all of the settlements are illegal. There's been no pressure put on the Israelis to stop expanding the settlements, let alone to dismantle them. And I don't think one thing is going to change until those settlements stop expanding and until they are absolutely dismantled and the occupation ends. It's the Israelis who are provoking their own security problem.
Well, many Israelis would agree with you, certainly. Israel would be far more secure behind internationally recognized borders and with the neighbors that recognize them and have security guarantees than to try to defend this archipelago of illegal settlements and isolated military outposts amidst a hostile population. Every single one of these settlements is illegal according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits any country from moving its civilian population onto territory seized by military force. And there have been no less than four U.N. Security Council resolutions, 446, 452, 465, and 471, which specifically call on Israel to withdraw from all of those settlements. And so the fact the United States has refused to enforce these resolutions and has allowed Israel to double the number of settlements since the Oslo Accords and continue to expand them in violation of the roadmap, even since Annapolis, it is indicative that the United States isn't willing to push Israel to live up to its negotiations. The U.S. has appropriately pushed the Palestinians to crack down on terrorism, and Abbas appears to have been largely successful at that, at least for now. But the roadmap was called for mutual simultaneous responsibilities, and the failure of Israel to live up to its responsibilities on these settlements, which, as you point out, is really a critical issue because they're being built on land that the Palestinians need to create a viable state. I think the failure of the U.S. to take this more seriously raises serious questions about how serious the Bush administration is about the peace process really working.
And I just wanted to make one additional comment. I recently heard Noam Chomsky give a speech on this topic in which he called the separation barrier an annexation wall, and I thought, what an apt label, because it really is a way of this wall of scooping in more Palestinian land into what the Israelis want to eventually have total control over.
And a near unanimous decision by the International Court of Justice, only the U.S. judge dissenting, largely on technicality, recognized that reality as well and underscored the illegality of this separation barrier. Unfortunately, an overwhelming bipartisan majority of Congress, along with the Bush administration, condemned the World Court for this and appears to be supporting Israel in its continued construction of this land grab, basically.
Thank you, Amy, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. When was the Oslo Accord?
Yeah, that was in September of 1993.
93, and they've doubled the number of settlements since then. That's amazing. How many people live in the settlements?
We're getting up to 400,000 or more. Most of these, however, are on these settlements that are right on the old border, which, again, the Palestinians indicated they're willing to give up in return for an equivalent amount of land, and which is now Israel. But the and there are many of the settlers, a disproportionate whom, incidentally, are American emigres, are strongly ideological and Jewish fundamentalists who say, you know, this is, God gave us this land, end of story, and we'll never give up, et cetera. But for the vast majority are there because of very generous subsidies and other incentives by the Israeli government to settle there. And if they could get a just as good an apartment on the Israeli side of the border, the vast majority would be quite willing to accept that.
And so tell me a little more about the reasoning. Knowing that this is a stumbling block, why would you see an expansion of twice the number of settlements since the Oslo Accord?
Well, it is kind of a land grab. I mean, I don't think that those I disagree with those who say that you know, Zionism or Israel is inherently expansionist and they never compromise, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not that cynical, but there are certainly strong elements for ideological or strategic or economic reasons that would like to control as much land as possible. The West Bank is very fertile land. It's been farmed and for centuries. Vineyards, almond orchards. I mean, it's a lovely area, and it also is where the largest aquifer in the semi-arid part of the world is located. And obviously, there are historic and religious significance to parts of it. And but from a strictly security perspective, it's been counterproductive. And it's interesting that some of the harshest critics of the settlement policies is not just the traditional left-wing or liberal elements within Israeli politics, but leading people in the military and security services, because they recognize that it's many of these are hard to defend on a purely logistical basis, but also that the settlements are the single biggest obstacle to a permanent peace settlement.
Right. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. He's written extensively about the Middle East, politics, foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, international terrorism, social movements, and human rights. He is the principal editor of Nonviolent Social Movements and the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. And he has traveled all over the Middle East and other conflict regions. He is a foreign affairs columnist for the National Catholic Reporter and a regular contributor to the Common Dreams website. His op-ed columns have been circulated and appeared in major daily newspapers throughout this country, Canada, and also in Europe. And he speaks widely on the many issues related to the elusive peace in the Middle East. Oh, we got a ton of phone calls now, so we'll take more of your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Friday, we'll talk politics again. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been polling and conducting what's been called a highly sophisticated voter analysis in all 50 states as he decides whether to launch an independent presidential bid. We'll be talking about whether or not he will and should enter the race, also looking at New Hampshire, looking at issues of race and gender, and, well, politics, second hour of our show. All right, let's go back to phone calls to George from Eau Claire next. Hi, George.
Good morning.
Hi.
The subject of Israeli-Palestinian relations is something that's been terribly, terribly neglected. Israel was the aggressor that started the 67 war to begin with. It was actually not provoked. It did it in anticipation of acquiring all the lands that it has. The UN and the International Court has condemned it and over and over and over. But it's,
I'm not sure I would call Israel the aggressor there. Would you, Professor Zunis?
There were real threats to Israel at that time, or at least perceived threats. I mean, in hindsight, we now know that it was more of an act of brinkmanship, that the Egyptians and others weren't actually planning an attack, but certainly from the Israeli perception at the time, it appeared to be, and one can make a case that this would be one of the rare circumstances where preemptive war might have had some legal justification, but certainly as a temporary thing. I certainly don't think Israel has had a right to hold on to this land ever since, especially since the Arab countries have wanted to make peace. But I think the initial decision to go to war was not necessarily a conscious effort at expansionism, albeit there have always been elements within Israel that have advocated that.
Yeah, sorry, George. So, I just wanted to follow up on what you said there. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, I strongly disagree. There was absolutely no basis whatsoever for Israel to attack Egypt to begin with. The Straits of Hormuz was an issue, and Israel...
you mean the Straits of Tehran at the base of the Gulf of Aqaba? The Straits of Hormuz are way over on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula.
Yes, it was. But this was not a basis. It was, in fact, a basis for Israel to acquire the lands that it has. And while the American, and particularly Congress, has gone along with this professor from Harvard that was the only really one to testify on behalf of Israel in support of its position that it had to attack because Egypt was going to attack Israel. It's been denounced by other international lawyers. It gets back to the fact that our Congress is completely dominated by AIPAC in regard to our foreign policy, and it's been a travesty for our foreign policy not only to diminish our stature in the Middle East but in the world, and also it's ludicrous when you think that we stand for international law and justice where we've supported the criminal activities of Israel.
Let me interject here. I certainly believe that Israel has violated international legal norms, continues to violate international legal norms, and it's wrong for the U.S. to support such violations of international legal norms. Remember, the U.S. also support Indonesia in its occupation and invasion and suppression of the people of East Timor. And more than a third of their people were wiped out in this Indonesian oppression. We continue to support Morocco and its occupation of Western Sahara more than 30 years after they invaded that North African country. So the United States is perfectly capable of supporting allies in these kinds of violations of international legal norms without an ethnic lobby somehow forcing our hand to do so. So in other words, I mean, obviously, AIPAC can be an intimidating force on Capitol Hill, and it made it difficult to have as much of a debate as this issue deserves. But frankly, I believe our policy towards Israel-Palestine, that region, would be more or less the same, even if AIPAC didn't exist.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to, is it Myra? Hello? All right, don't know where you are. Let's go next to John from Milwaukee. What's going on here? My phone seemed to be bizarre. Roy, hello, from Iron County.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead, Roy.
I would like to ask a question about Israel in particular. They were cluster bombing Iran, and Bush says, oh, you can't interfere in that, and that's absolutely against the Geneva Convention. How are they going to come up with a program for Palestine when they can't even get along with Iran?
I'm not sure of the. I haven't heard about the cluster bombing in Iran. I know the United States has provided a number of countries in that part of the world, including Israel, with cluster bombs that were used with great devastation in Lebanon during the campaign in the summer of 2006. In fact, kids, unfortunately, are still being blown up in southern Lebanon from an explosion ordnance. There's an effort in Congress to restrict U.S. transfer of cluster bombs in situations where they had a high failure rate and could have civilian casualties, but it was defeated with the effort led by Senator Clinton and others who didn't want such restrictions on these deadly anti-personnel weapons. But I think I think you're off in the specifics of your question. I think the general question is that if the United States is going to have any credibility, whether it be in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or in promoting democracy or human rights elsewhere in that part of the world, we got to end this double standard. That's why we have international humanitarian law, to have something that applies to everybody, regardless of the nature of their government or their relations with a superpower. And I think less than until the United States is able to have a single yardstick on issues of international law, human rights, nonproliferation, democracy, and the like. Anything that we try to do in that part of the world, even if it's for a good cause, is not going to have much credibility.
Let's talk a little bit more about credibility. What kind of credibility? We keep hearing about how so many nations in that part of the world are justifiably upset with us about our actions in Iraq and the fact that we haven't paid attention to Israel and Palestine for a long period of time. What kind of credibility does the president bring to the table in all of these discussions? It seems as though he still has some, right? Or you wouldn't have all those people showing up at the Annapolis conference.
It's unfortunate, really, that we've gone from having unprecedented sympathy in that part of the world in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 to unprecedented hostility. And I really do think that it's been part of the misguided policies of the administration. Bush remains very unpopular in that part of the world, as he does in much of the world. At the same time, there is recognition that the United States is the world's only remaining superpower, that the United States does have a lot of leverage, and that needs to be respected. And so I think that, and many of the governments that are welcoming President Bush so enthusiastically, if you look at Egypt and UAE, Bahrain, et cetera, I mean, these regimes are in power in large part because of U.S. security assistance and the like. And so they are certainly grateful to and are on good terms with President Bush, even if their people have more negative feelings. And so the fact is that there's this real mix of feelings. There is concern about this particular administration, but there's also recognition of American power. And the question is whose side is the United States on? Are we going to continue to support these various Arab despots? Or are we going to have a policy that represents more of the needs of the people? Are we going to continue to give 10 times more military aid to that part of the world than we give development aid? Mm-hmm. Or are we going to try to improve the lives of the people in that part of the world so they are less prone to extremist ideologies? I mean, mm-hmm. I think these are really the big questions we should be asking.
Yeah. So whose side are we on?
We've seen in other parts of the world, including Latin. I mean, in many ways, I would say it's analogous to our policy towards Latin America during the Cold War, that we were willing to prop up these dictatorships in the name of anti-communism, but ironically, we would create more communists because when people were unable to express their needs for social reform and greater freedoms democratically and nonviolently, they were prone to embrace more extreme ideologies. It reminds me of President Kennedy's famous quote that those who make peaceful evolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And the trouble with our policies, and not just under Bush, I think the previous administrations of both parties had a similar era, is that we end up creating terrorists faster than we can kill them by becoming identified not with freedom and democracy, but with support of repressive dictatorships and occupation armies.
Thanks very much, Roy, for the call. Mira from Washburn, hi.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
Yep, okay. I wanted to comment. Somebody mentioned that people living in the territories now in the West Bank are living there for purely the benefits that the state gives them. And I can tell you that is not true. As a person who lived in Israel for many years and lived in the West Bank, it is a cheaper standard of living, but that's purely supply and demand, as cost of living goes probably everywhere in the world. Before Oslo, you probably had more people living there because it was cheaper, but after the Intifada started and it became a more dangerous place, all of those people left, and the people that are living there now are doing it purely for ideological reasons because nobody else puts up with that way of life. It's not an easy way of life. And...
It depends on which settlements you're talking about. If you're including, of course, the large settlement blocks on Etzion and Great Jerusalem, I would say, and I think polling data confirms this, that the majority are not there for ideological reasons. I mean, certainly if you go to Hebron and places like that, these are people who are more ideologically driven, but. The polling data still indicates that the vast majority are willing to relocate if it is what is necessary to bring peace.
Mm-hmm. And thanks very much for your call. We are out of time. Professor Zunis, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Oh, my pleasure. Enjoyed being
here. It was a good discussion. And in a complicated whole set of ideas, isn't it? Professor Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, where he has taught since 1995, the author of many articles on Middle Eastern politics, U.S. foreign policy, international terrorism. He's the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and also of Western Sahara, Nationalism and Conflict in Northwest Africa. He was the recipient of a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship on Middle Eastern and Central Asian Studies at Dartmouth College, and also was the founding director of the Institute for a New Middle East Policy, and has traveled extensively in that part of the world. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll talk more politics following the news, so stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.